Today, profanity and art continued.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Again, I'll give you the alert ahead of time. I'm not going to pronounce any profanity. We're not going to actually give profane examples that are profane. So you don't have to fear, you know, what you're listening to in the moment. But I do think the reality is we have talked about Christianity and art and how Christians respond to art. And eventually you have to deal with how you respond to art that contains profanity in one sense or another. And there are all kinds of different lines to be drawn, all kinds of different standards that can be given. So acknowledging that up front, you're just going to run into it. And so I want us to have a good way of understanding it. So we spent a little time using humor because humor has an inherent relationship with profanity. It's not inherently necessary that to be funny, you have to be profane. That's not the case. But it is the case that profanity has a built-in relationship with certain forms of humor and certain ways of getting to humor. So you can listen to the previous episode and hear why that is and why it's important. But I brought up humor as the illustration and then want to use art as the bridge between, because when we get to the discussion about profanity, I think it'll make more sense in the light of understanding that what profanity accomplishes often for us is exactly the same thing that humor accomplishes for us in different ways, obviously. Humor working through humor, that's different than profanity working through being provocative of its own accord. It doesn't matter whether it's funny or not. Sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's not. But it's still accomplishing the same thing that the funny form accomplishes. So that's what I want us to get to. On the way there, we were using art as this bridge in the middle because one of the things art necessarily does, I mean, and necessarily by that I mean it's in its nature to do this. Art is bringing us to the edge of the things that we experience in the same way humor does and in the same way, as we're going to discuss it, profanity does. So because art is taking us where we wouldn't go on our own or where we couldn't go on our own, I just want to make sure we understand what we mean by that. And so we talked about the ends of drama and art in these forms of drama and comedy, for instance, that, and I'm just using those as the examples in terms of performance types of art, but whether it's drama and comedy and narrative or in paintings or in whatever it is that you're encountering, we talked about the end goal of that being sometimes escape, sometimes provocation, sometimes other things. But now the means is what we're at. And, you know, whatever kind of art you're looking at does in order to get you to that place of escape or to get you to that place where you're contemplating things that you wouldn't normally want to think about and so on. And one of the means, and I mentioned these briefly before just giving sort of a list, is sensationalism. There is a form, there are all kinds of forms of art that rely on overwhelming the sensors that you have. And it might be sight or smell or taste or touch or any of them. And you've probably at least heard of displays in museums that involve textures, for instance, and you put your fingers on something in order to encounter it and see what it's like. And in fact, even in some natural museums, that's the method of getting people to interact with certain substances. Well, you need to feel this, see what it's like. And that actually, of its own accord, has an aesthetic value to it, even in those natural museums. That's not the point here, but the point here is to say some forms of art are getting you where you wouldn't normally go by giving you an intolerable amount of data for your sense receptors, right? So overwhelming your sensors. And if you want to think of illustrations of how that happens, probably the easiest and most obvious is musical concerts. And I don't mean by that normally a classical musical concert, although sometimes those can be a little overwhelming. But I mean, when you go to a concert with rock or pop music or whatever, it is, and I've only been to one. I've been to a few since then in smaller venues for other reasons, date night and stuff like that. But I mean, going to a concert, in a big stadium or a whatever, I've been to one of those. And my experience wasn't unique. I know, because everybody's deaf the day after they go to a concert. It is crushing. It is bone shattering kind of sound. And part of the purpose of that is to drown out every other sensory input. You are going to hear this and nothing else. And that's a part of the escapist nature of the aesthetic value of that thing that you're encountering. Now, I know for some people it's not appealing at all, but, and for some people at church, their music is that way as well. I mean, the church music is loud and it's intended to match the concert thing, and it becomes part of that curtain that you put around your congregation to separate them from all the other distractions that might get their attention. I mean, whether you like that or don't like it, I mean, that's part of what's going on with it in some church settings. They're using that technique. The same thing with, and I haven't been to one of these. There are several different versions of this. I don't even know what their official name is, but I've seen them advertised, and they've had them here in the Dallas area, for instance, but the Van Gogh Experience or whatever they're called. But you know what I'm talking about? When they have these whole rooms that are illuminated with the images and the colors and so on of Van Gogh or whoever the artist is that they're focusing on. Again, it's to shut out everything else and immerse you. In fact, they call it an immersive experience. That's the point. So we're going to drown you in this sense data. And that's part, aside from the beauty of the colors, aside from what you would see if you were standing in front of a painting, because you can do all that with just a print. Just put it on the wall, let me look at it. The whole idea here is that there is also an aesthetic value to being overwhelmed in your senses in this way. And by the way, it's not distinct from the less extreme examples you can give of it, of darkening the theater before you see the play begin or before the movie actually begins and so on, or even just telling people to silence their phones because you don't want the intrusion of the outside world in it. So you get the idea of sensationalism being one of the methods of creating those end goals that aesthetics have of giving you a place of escape or a place to provoke you with ideas you wouldn't have thought of otherwise or been willing to deal with otherwise. Second technique, one is sensationalism. And these are not comprehensive by any stretch of the imagination. They're just simple examples. The second example of a technique would be intentionality and meaningfulness. This is built into the nature of art to begin with, and you can go back to Christianity and art and hear some of that and understand what I mean by it. But it's just how much deliberateness the artist is putting into every element of what's going on in that work, whatever the work is. And part of the intentionality and meaningfulness of what you're looking at is bringing about this opportunity for you to have the rest of your consciousness overwhelmed by your need to pay attention to all the details. You know, don't distract me right now. I'm trying to pay attention to this part of the movie, or I'm trying to hear this line that's being uttered, or I'm trying to understand this piece of music that's being played, or whatever it is. You just can't contribute. You can't give any of your consciousness to something else and also pay attention to this. It's why, in my experience, it's really frustrating for me that this is the case. There are magnificent classical music pieces that I love to hear, and I would give myself to pay attention to and would love to play in the background. But I can't. I can't play them in the background because as soon as they start playing, they demand all of my attention, and I can't do anything else. So I'm trying to write something. I can't play classical music. It just distracts me completely. If I'm trying to write something and I play some you know, just nonsense music, pop music, rock music, some kind of background music, whatever, light, fluffy stuff. I can write better than I can write in silence because I don't know what it does. I mean, I have read that book, Your Mind on Music or Your Brain on Music, I think it's called. And so I do understand that when that music stimulates the brain, it gets different parts of the brain functioning at a higher level, and that contributes to your overall thought processes. So I get that. I mean, I do understand it in that sense. If that's true, I mean, it seems true, and it seemed demonstrably true. But practically, for me, I just know it works. If I sit in a still, quiet room and write, it is like being at the... I really appreciate my dentist, so I'm not trying to be critical here. But I mean, it is, you know, it's not my favorite thing to do. And so I got a much better dentist now, and that means my dentist is willing to make me unconscious. So that's all I mean by having a much better dentist. But he is really good. So no criticism implied about dentistry. But my point is, you know, normally that's what writing is like for me normally. It's sort of mind-numbing after a while. If I play music in the background, the music doesn't distract me at all. And it's like, all right, it's like riding a bike downhill the whole way. It's so much more fun to write. So I don't know why it's able to do it, but it's able to do it. But one of the reasons I think that's the case is because classical music has a lot more intentionality to it. And I'm not saying that is an insulting way to pop music, which is fantastic, and rock music, which is fantastic, and hip hop, which is fantastic. I'm glad for all the people who produce all those kinds of music. I didn't mention country, but I probably should. Anyway, the point is, I'm happy for all of those, but I mean, there is a different level of intentionality when you get to really complex classical music. And I'm not judging it morally. I'm just talking about the level of intentionality in the music. And so it demands all of your attention. By the way, it's the same reason those drama comedies, different versions that are driven by, and there you'll recognize what I mean if you've ever seen one of these, but there are some comedies or some dramas where the whole event is driven by this rapid-fire repartee that's going on between the characters. It's so fast, it's almost impossible to keep up with, but that's part of the aesthetic value, that your mind is inherently completely absorbed in just catching all the little nuances and puns of the interactions that are going on in that interchange. And by the way, it's the same reason that images like the Mona Lisa are so obviously appealing and beautiful and magnificent and so on. But, you know, the term that goes with the Mona Lisa, the whole point of it is, why on earth is this so perfect as a painting? What is it about it? The enigmatic nature of that smile, for instance, on the Mona Lisa is part of what's built into it. Because you look at it and you can study it, and people have studied it for centuries now, in order to figure out what's going on that makes this so perfect. And you can explain it in so many different details. There are so many different ways you can understand it. But all of those different ways are an invitation to pay attention uniquely to this. Even with that enigmatic smile, knowing that if you stare right at it, it looks one way. And if you look a little off to the side, it looks completely different. And that Leonardo da Vinci probably painted it on purpose to do that, because he understood that you see different things with your peripheral vision than you see with your direct vision. That kind of intentionality automatically draws you out of the mundane world that's just driving you crazy and allows you to focus on something different. One of the means of art for dragging you into these provocations or toward an escape from the world where you're dealing with everything else. The other thing is just pure contrast, that you are put in it when you're in the presence of an aesthetic piece, when you're in the presence of a piece of art, of something beautiful produced by a person is what I mean by art. Aesthetic would be anything beautiful. In this case, I mean by something produced by a person, but you could do it. You know, when you go see a mountain and think of it as beautiful, it's because it's in contrast with what you normally see. the people who live in Colorado see the mountain every day. You're like, oh, have you seen Pagosa Peak? And they're like, yeah, whatever. It's not a big deal to them. It's a huge deal because of the contrast. So in the same way, art creates a contrast with everyday things, with the mundane things of life. And so if you think of art in terms of the poetic, then the contrasts are most profound with poets like Gerard Manley Hopkins, one of my favorite poems of all time. And I've probably gone through this in an episode before, but I'm just going to, some of these words, I'm just going to read them to make the point that you normally would not run into someone and say to them, hey, how's your morning going? And they say, I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dappled dawn-drawn falcon, in his riding of the rolling level underneath him, steady air, and striding high up there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Hey, man, have a great day. it's just not, it the contrast. Now, obviously, it's not just a contrast. It's not just mumbo jumbo. It's perfectly intentionally ordered contrast with the average things that we would normally say. And so it draws us towards something that's not normal. That's the point, that it takes us where we wouldn't or couldn't go on our own by giving us this artistic content. The same thing with the profane, basically, by the way. That, and I'm just going to give an example of profanity in art here without saying it. I won't need to say it. You'll know it. Back in the day when this was produced, I don't know, it was 1930s or something like that. When Gone with the Wind was produced, you'll remember that you have this whole time of building up this this character that's so despicable and so aggravating and frustrating, and Rhett Butler, who is being aggravated and frustrated and sort of used by this character and so on. I don't remember any of the details. I was a kid when I saw Gone with the Wind. The point is that at the end of the movie, by the time Rhett Butler says his last line, frankly, my dear, and that's it. I won't say the rest because I'm not trying to provoke anyone here. But the point is, when you hear the last line, of course there's the outcry because nobody said profanity in the movies that were approved at the time. It's not like nobody did anything profane in movies back then, but in the movies that were approved in the time. And this movie, was a major cinematic production and it was a huge value and so on. The fact that this man was uttering profanity at the end of it was there's a hue and cry. We can't do that. Change the word. The censors should stop it and so on. But it would miss the whole point that by the end of the movie, you're so frustrated with what's been going on. You hear a final total release in his ability to say, I don't care anymore. But those words weren't strong enough. And so he said something else. Good, bad, or indifferent, the point is they wanted to get you to that emotional release that came with being shocked that he would say that word at the end of the movie. That's the idea that I'm talking about, because it was a contrast with what would normally be acceptable, at least to some of the people who were present in that audience. And by the way, you can also do it with action. It doesn't have to be visual, doesn't have to be auditory, whatever. It can just be, some part of action's response is visual, of course. But I'm saying it can be in the acts themselves. So sometimes the actions are representing something. So we're going to display for you what happened in this critical moment of our history, and we're going to reenact it. And in the reenactment, you have a heroic action, for instance, or something extremely painful, whatever it was. And by reenacting it, but in a setting where the actors are choosing to participate in this, you give a contrast with where it actually happened, but also the mundaneness of everyday life. And so you have an ability to process something you wouldn't normally have been able to process. If you were watching it in the moment, you would have been caught up in the moment. What's going to be the outcome? What are we going to win or lose the war? Is this person going to live or die? And how tragic that a person has a disease and so on. But instead, in this aesthetic setting, you have the opportunity to encounter the emotions that are behind it and the virtue or decisions that were leading up to it and so on. So representation can be an important aesthetic form. that drags us toward either escape or an encounter with something that we normally wouldn't be willing to encounter. Lionization is a form of the same thing, you know, giving these encomiums, these praising eulogies or whatever that lift up a person and describe them in a way that's probably not realistic, but does draw us closer to the heavens because we see a demigod who's been walking among us or something like that. And also, by the way, humanization, taking a person who's been so far removed in our imagination from the reality of everyday life that we bring them back down to an incarnation and a point where we actually can encounter them. I'd love to talk about all of these in much greater detail, but the point is to move on to profanity in just a second. Choreography and order can do the same thing, by the way, because when people are planning their movements in the moment, they don't turn out perfectly. Even a Jackie Chan can't climb every set of walls that he encounters on the first try. But in a movie, he can. And then it's beautiful. Anyway, and then it also is true with sexuality. And here's the thing that here's the reason I want to mention it. And this doesn't go, again, you don't have to be nervous about this. It's not going to take you anywhere uncomfortable. I'm not using profanity to provoke you today. I'm just talking about how people can. But with sexuality in particular, you do have the opportunity, and this one's not even a profane example. There's nothing profane in the example at all, because the point here is not profanity, it's art. Why does art so often brush up against the question or issue or opportunity for intimacy or sexuality? And the reason is because of the contrast between that and so much of the rest of life. There is no higher expression. There's no deeper, more sincere possible expression of human intimacy. I mean, it's just part of the reality of life. It's why a marriage is what it is and all that kind of stuff. So when you encounter these references to sexuality, to an intimate relationship between people, it can be just cheap. We'll talk about that in the profanity section in a minute. But it also can just be a way for the artist to say, this is not something you can skip past. This is one of the most important moments of life. And one of the greatest pieces of writing I know of in any form, anywhere, is in T.S. Eliot's Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, when he says, after all of this buildup, and it's considerable, of a person trying to decide whether they're going to go do anything or not, and whether that person is actually going to, for instance, go on a date or not. And they never do in reality in the poem. But imagining that they might, they say this, would it have been worth, this is what T.S. Eliot says in this, I think, most profound line. Would it have been worth, it's more than one line, but most profound little section. Would it have been worthwhile if one, and again, get the nuance and I'll let you sense the subtlety of it. But the pain at the end is just unbearable if you think about what it means. Would it have been worthwhile, because this is a person who feels so isolated, would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. Now, again, I'll read it to you one more time just so you can process what it's saying. But, you know, the reference to the pillow and all of that, you know what pillow talk is. So the statement is, so you've had the most intimate experience you can possibly have in life. Would it have been worthwhile if this is the result? So would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all. That is not what I meant at all. That you still have no connection with them whatsoever. That would be, it makes me cry while I think about it. So it would just be the saddest thing possible. Okay, so you get the idea of how all these different methods in art are trying to take us to a place we wouldn't normally have gone, one as an opportunity for escape, but another as an opportunity for provocation to think about things we might not have thought of otherwise. So now, finally, profanity, how profanity is involved in all of this. So what profanity does, and now that we've talked about humor and art, I think I can run through this pretty quickly and make sense of it. Actually, I'm looking at my notes and thinking, oh, my goodness. Well, So I think I can. I think we can do this. We're going to give it a try. So profanity, first of all, just like humor, it confronts us with things that are unacceptable. And so, and this is just generally true because, I mean, it's profane because it's unacceptable, right? We mean the same thing by those two concepts. So it's unacceptable. It's profane. This is not allowable. And so in general, profanity is valuable. And I haven't talked about why it's valuable yet, but you can tell why, because I'm saying it's going to drag a person to where they wouldn't normally have gone. That doesn't mean I think you should pursue it. This is not a statement about whether we should value using it or not. This is not about that. We wouldn't use it. The question is, when we're confronted with it, what are we supposed to do with it? And one of the things that profanity does by taking us to places that are unacceptable is acknowledge the reality that it's still unacceptable. Profanity's value is the fact that it is excluded from acceptability. If profanity becomes ordinary, it doesn't carry any semantic or emotional freight at all. I had a friend in India who used profanity so much for so much of his life. And this is a friend who went with me to India, and he was in his 80s. And so I only knew him from this encounter. But we talked about this explicitly because he used a word. He used the word for, you know, H-E double toothpicks, right? So I told you I wouldn't use any profanity at all. So I'm not using any. I'm not even referring to the place. It's just that profane word that people say sometimes, you know? And he had used it as profanity so much that it just became part of his flow of speech. And so in the same way, you or I would say the word well between words or between phrases. Well, you know, he's going to go and well, you know, he did it with that word instead of well. And he did it all the time. And he didn't mean anything by it. He was smiling and happy and friendly and cooperative and constantly cursing in everybody else's ears. But in his mind, he wasn't doing it at all. That, my point to you is to say that. I mean, it didn't have any meaning to us other than being offensive because he wasn't trying to mean anything by it. And it didn't have any meaning to him because it had lost its meaning by becoming just a normal part of his speech pattern. So when it loses its unacceptability, it also loses its value. Now, I have to, you know, tuck a little element in here just about the reality that we're not the determiners of everybody's moral standards. And so it's important to remember, and again, this is I'm not questioning at all that there are absolute standards. There absolutely are absolute standards, but they're not linguistic. Languages aren't even the same. The word God in Russian isn't the same as the word God in English. And there are words in Chinese that sound for all the world like a curse word in English. And they don't have anything to do with cursing. So linguistic standards are inherently relative to the culture. And even some behavioral standards are relative to the culture. They're cultural. They're not absolute. So there are absolutes, like you have to be kind to people. You have to greet people. You have to dismiss people with courtesy and so on. Those are moral standards that exist in every society, but how you do it is different in every society. If you're going to kiss people in Brazil, okay, but don't go doing that in India because they have a different understanding about when you should make contact with people and how you should do it. So it's relative in that sense. That's what I mean by it. Profanity is the same way because the moral standards have different expressions in different cultures. So modesty in one culture would be different from modesty in another culture in the same way that profane language in one culture or subculture would be different than profane language in a different subculture. So when profanity becomes ordinary for others, it may simply mean for them that it's just not profane anymore. It's just part of the sprinkling of language. And that it would be offensive to us. Every time we hear it, we would shudder at it. But it wouldn't mean anything offensive to them, and they wouldn't be trying to be offensive with it. I'm saying all of that to say one of the questions we have to ask when we're confronted with some kind of profanity is whether it's being used as a provocation. They intended for that to be profane. Or if it's simply a cultural divergence, you know, they have a different vocabulary than you have. And just get over it. You know, don't be quite as judgmental about that. Now, that's, again, a discussion for another day, and we can have more discussion another day. But it definitely would mean something different for a person who uses that word every day to include it in a play or in a piece of art of other kind, some other kind of art, than it would for a person who never uses that word but needed their character to say it because they wanted to get something across. Those are two completely different ideas. So while profanity, and we're acknowledging this, is unacceptable, that's the point, the thing that brings it value even to the people who do use it. Not us, we're not using it, but to the people who do use it, the value it brings is that it's unacceptable, that it provokes a response in the people who don't accept it. So it's so while it's unacceptable, it still has the ability to shock the apathetic. You know, a lot of us are that before we're dragged into what we need to think about, to drag the apathetic out of their stupor. So even for non-believers, its use, profanity's use, has to be selective in order for it to be effective. If it's everywhere, then it's no longer recognized as something provocative. It's just the norm, and it's no longer valuable. This is, if I had a lot more time, we would talk about this for a few minutes. It's exactly parallel, and it's built into the nature of the sacred center that I have talked about with you before on previous episodes, and then the profane outer realm. So the sacred center is something that shows up in literature and in the way we think about the world. The home is a sacred center. A synagogue or a church or a chapel or a steeple is a sacred center. It's the thing that you're drawn to and where you find safety and order and things are right. You know, we think of the Garden of Eden as a sacred center. All of those are sacred. The things that are outside of it, those are profane. They're dangerous. They're uncertain. They're chaotic. They are, you know, needing to be under the realm of control and order and God, but they're not. And now, of course, I know God is over all things. I'm saying in the Old Testament sense, the way Jonah would have thought of going to the Mediterranean as a way of escaping God's presence, realizing the stupidity of that later. All of that kind of thinking is about a sacred center and the outer bounds. So if you're at the sacred center, you know, you're just sitting at the table having a meal with your family. There's great value in that in terms of the relationships and the comfort and the sense of belonging and all of those things. But nothing's going to change while you're doing that. You're not there for change. When you go out, when you go to the fence line, when you go out into the woods and you face the danger, when you go on the hunt, when you have to go to war, when you have to get on the ship and go out to sea, when you take those risks, that's when you're learning things, when you're being confronted with things, when you're being provoked, or sometimes when you're escaping. The point is that the sacred center is where you would not find the profane, and across the fence line, out in the middle of the dark woods, is where you would find the profane. And you would know that's not where you want to be. That's not where you want to stay. You want to come back. But that's where it takes place. Profanity is like that. In our encounters with it, in our experiences with it, it can force us into realizations, into changes, into awareness that we would not have obtained before. And again, we could do a lot more on the sacred center and all that, but just want the parallel to be there for you as we talk about the rest of this, because now I finally get to the point I really wanted to make, which is talking about how believers are supposed to think about profanity when you encounter it. So, and these are not, again, this is not for me. It doesn't, the question is not whether a believer should use profanity. The answer to that is it's just inherently no. And I don't mean by that you can't have a different standard of what is or isn't profane. That's just true. You can be around other believers who use language you're not comfortable with, and they're not being profane at all in their context. So that, again, you have to take into consideration. But using profanity itself because it's profane as a believer, it's not a valid option for us in this sense. Using profanity is, by its extreme nature, evidence that we would not be centered in our faith, but would be out where the risks or the dangers are. Now, again, there are reasons to be out there where the risks and the dangers are, but we don't have to create those risks and dangers. And it's just a different concept altogether. So if you think about it in terms of believers and the language that we use about it, our language is supposed to be seasoned with grace. That's the nature of Christian language. Are we always there? Of course not. But we're talking about normative standards here. And so the ideas of Ephesians 5 make a little more sense when you hear them in the context of saying not, you can't do this, or you can't touch that, or you can't say that word. It's not that. It's that we ought to be children of light. We ought to have peace. We ought to be demonstrating grace. We ought to be walking like those who are emulating our Father in heaven and are therefore the children of light. That's the idea in Ephesians 5 when it says in the middle of that, let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. By the way, this limitation is a real challenge for me, because the nature of a lot of humor is also provocative in the same way, just as I was talking about in the beginning of the discussion in the previous episode. And I love humor. I love sarcasm. I love being sardonic. I like all of the sides of humor. I don't like saying anything that just fits the normal mold. I feel like it's a waste of breath. Why do you even say words like that? So for me, being provocative is just sort of central to who I am. And yet, it's really risky in terms of saying, all I'm ever expressing is thanksgiving. And I did realize over a while that some of the humor I was using was costing other people, that it was, you know, somehow threatening their self-worth or image or something like that. And learning not to do that has been a big part of my discipleship and growing into trying to be a better follower of Christ. But it has to do with whether we're supposed to be the people who are crossing those lines, and we're not supposed to be. Does that mean we never do? No. Does it mean we ever can't? No. But it just means that's not when we're centered in our faith, right? So that's not our goal. And by the way, in action, it's the same way. I have to look at my life and say, am I demonstrating the fruit of the Spirit? Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Is that what my life is about? Or if I say, well, you know, as a believer, I've got liberty I can live in. But if it involves the things that Paul lists in Galatians 5, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, things like these. He doesn't even end the list. He just says things like these. The point is, if I'm living in those things that are across the profane line, then I've got to question the activity of the Holy Spirit in my life. I've got to say to myself, I'm not following the Spirit here, because the fruit of the Spirit is the opposite of all of that. So the question isn't, can believers do this or not? That's not what it's about. What it's about is how we receive profanity and art and other expressions. This is the point I want to get to. That is, can we receive profanity and art as evidence that the one who's expressing the profanity is let me give a contrast to this first. It is just as likely that an artist uses profanity because they're just not that smart and they can't be clever enough to do something that would keep your attention. So they use profanity because it's an attention getter. Inherently, profanity does that. So that's a legitimate possible response that a Christian should have to art. That you would say, well, the person who did this is just not very creative. They didn't have enough energy to spend time to find a better way to keep your attention, or they didn't have enough intelligence to be clever enough or arbitrary enough to get you to watch the Ministry of Silly Walks, you know, in Monty Python. So too bad for them. They're not a very good artist, and they use profanity to cover it up. That's a legitimate response. That happens all the time, okay? So that I don't mind that judgment at all. As a non-believer, a person who's evaluating art can say that. And so we're not being puritanical by doing that. We're just looking at it and saying, I mean, come on, do better than that. You can be smarter than that. But the other option is that we encounter profanity in art and realize that the one who's expressing the profanity is approaching a subject matter that is too eccentric. It's too offensive. It's too grave. It's too incomprehensible to be described within our comfortable boundaries. Again, I'll give the illustration I've given before, but so the idea that someone would produce a movie about the Holocaust and have some character say, oh, those, and use a euphemism in the actual movie, use a euphemism instead of, you know, a genuine expression of human exhaustion and frustration with evil in the world, and say, oh, that gosh darn Holocaust, you know, nobody's going to do that. The Holocaust, I'm not saying a believer would express this in their faith and in the spirit, but I am saying a believer could respond to someone using profanity to explain some of the worst events in human history and say, oh, I see how hurt that person would have been and how empty, how lost they would have felt. And sincerely, how much worse is it really for a person to have used some term that offends our sensitivities than for the psalmist at times to say to God, are you sleeping? Wake up. Why would we think that this form of profanity that offends our sensitivities is worse than that? And the other is in Scripture as something the people of God are supposed to have in their back pocket as a song to bring up to God when they feel those things. So you see the point I'm making. It is possible. Now, it's not always the case. Again, it's certainly not always justified, but it's certainly possible that a legitimate artist could be using profanity to provoke, and in fact, they could be provoking across cultural lines, the very people who are too complacent to recognize the pain that their subculture is going through. And in this particular case, I'm thinking of a person like Dave Chappelle. I mean, if you hear some of the things that are said, it is intentionally provocative. It's why some of the profanity of action in people like a Willie Nelson, where pot is a big part of what's going on in their life. I don't have any respect for that. I'm not advocating that that's okay or anything like it. And part of it is just people like to get high and they want to do selfish things. I'm not discounting that. But also part of it is saying, you people who have your standards so high have no grasp of what's really valuable in life. And so you can live your lives over there, but we're going to celebrate our culture over here in a different way. And we're going to try to use it to provoke you with what you would think is profane. That's sometimes what they're doing. And again, I'm not justifying the behavior. I'm saying we could hear the pain or the emptiness or the critique that's in that artist's statements instead of just dismissing it. Oh, well, that's just such a loser. And again, there are plenty of losers who use profanity. So there are opportunities for doing that. But there is also this other side of provoking us or dragging us where we would not have gone otherwise. So when we're presented with material that we find offensive, here are the basic things that I would give you. Just a little short conclusion to the matter. One, I think we have to remind ourselves of who we're supposed to be like. So are we supposed to be, and think of this in terms of the story of the woman taken in adultery. The question is, are we supposed to be, or are we standing with the accusers? We're pointing a condemning finger at a guilty person, and they are guilty. I mean, the reason the language they're using is offensive is because it's offensive. It is offensive, and they're using it, so they're guilty. We can point our finger at the adulterous woman and say, she's guilty. What are you going to do about this, Jesus? Are we standing with them, or are we standing next to Jesus, extending grace to a woman who really is guilty? Again, not justifying the behavior, but extending grace to the woman who really is guilty and sending her on her way while giving his only, Jesus does this, gives his only condemnation in that entire story to the religious leaders, who were right, by the way. She was wrong because they couldn't see past the condemnation into the person that they were condemning. That's the trick. That's what I'm talking about. It's not saying, oh, profanity's fine. We should be okay with profanity. Can you see past, can we see past the condemnation that we want to give about the profanity to the person who was drawn toward that profanity, who felt compelled to express that profanity? And again, I'm talking about in those cases where it is provoking us to think what we would not have thought otherwise. And so I'm hoping that the choice of where we ought to stand is as obvious as the fact that we're not very often standing there. We're so offended by the profanity, we just cut it out. We just cut the person out, we ignore the person, just pronounce the judgment. We can use confrontations with this kind of material to change sides, to stand a little further from self-congratulatory religion and judgment, and a little closer to the condemned, and therefore a little closer to Jesus.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.